This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the return of writer, director, and actor, Naar Murad.
Hi, thanks, Cam, for having me again.
Yes. And we also have the return of writer, director, stand-up comedian, and persons whose face I cannot see because the microphone is blocking
out,
Charmaine Othman.
Hello, thanks for having me back again.
Great to have you. And our three topics this week are, topic number one is, does Hollywood know what Asia wants? Topic number two is the anatomy of a joke. And finally, topic number three is colorblind casting in Malaysia.
Oh, sounds like more fun than anybody can
think. Yeah, Charmaine's idea of a snappy title. So, Naar.
Yes.
Does Hollywood know what Asia wants?
Well, yeah, in a word, no. But first, may I congratulate everybody at BFM for this fantastic new office, which I've just seen for the first time today. It's really nice. I know it's radio, so you can't imagine it, but...
Let's just say you could shoot a film here.
Yeah, it's like The Post. Yeah, you could see Meryl Streep swanning up and down. Okay, well, Hollywood. Yeah, looking at the numbers even, right, you see that Crazy Rich Asians has made over 100 million in America. It's made barely 40 million the rest of the world and hardly anything in Asia. Hardly a little bip on the whole thing. Whereas things like The Nun has grossed a lot in Asia.
So what's The Nun?
The Nun is a James Wan horror thing. It is part of the Conjuring Annabelle universe of very scary stories.
Okay.
And on the other hand, something like The Meg has done well.
The what?
The Meg, the one
Jason
about a giant
Statham
shark.
Do you
actually watch films?
Jason Statham, do you use the highway? Have you not seen the billboards?
Okay.
Giant shark, Jason Statham. Need I say more?
Right.
So it's like with the attempt that Hollywood has of putting in Asian characters in movies like The Meg, it doesn't really matter. Because I think in Asia, particularly China, or the bigger Asian markets, they want to see their own characters, their own faces. Let's say, you know, Koreans want to see Koreans in a context created by themselves. They want to see their own stars. They are probably not interested in seeing a Hollywoodized version. I do believe that CRA, Crazy Rich Asians, is a film for Asian Americans who see it as a little bit of a fairy tale, a little bit of a fantasy, right? Going back to the homeland kind of thing, you know, eating satay.
I always thought it was weird that it was a film meant for Asian American audiences, but the characters, I mean, Rachel, Constance Wu's character was like the only American, Asian American. Mm. Everyone else was like Southeast Asian, Asians. It was an odd mix. Because the author was Singaporean, the screenwriter was Malaysian. So I don't even know Hollywood knows what Asian Americans want.
I think the Constance Wu, she's really good though. I really liked her and her character. She's like Alice and the rest is kind of Wonderland. An Asian Wonderland where it's things which are familiar yet not.
Yeah,
but you don't make 100 million at the box office just selling to Asian Americans.
That's true.
It had to
go way beyond that.
I saw like one of the interviews in like the southern states, like, you know, the ones who were watching it were not, you know, really Asians, like the whites, and everyone was watching it. So maybe it was a nice story, rom-com. Yeah.
Was it just that? I mean, is the Asia in inverted commas that it portrayed exotic? Was it an exotica? Was it some sort of hyper?
Yeah, certainly. Maybe slightly exaggerated. A few clichés. You know, you've got the whole cliché of the disapproving traditional mother, that kind of stuff. Which is probably, you know, interesting to even a farmer in Iowa, I would imagine. We were talking about rom-coms earlier. Mm. There hasn't been a hyped rom-com for a long time. And I think the American movie audience is dying to watch something romantic and
this is very new for them because, like, even the food in this rom-com was different, you know, dumplings and rice, you know. It's like how maybe, you know, when Bollywood films go to Europe,
Everything is strange and
different,
beautiful.
Different, right? So they're like, maybe this is just that approach.
I think one way of perhaps really gauging the success of it would be to find out next year if tourist arrivals from, especially the States, go up.
In Singapore.
And Malaysia as well. But, you know, talk about selling of Hollywood movies to Asia. One movie that really struck me was Rogue One.
Yeah.
And how in Rogue One you had two Asian, say, actors, Hong Kong actors who are very well known out in Hong Kong Chinese movie worlds, and they were given roles which were not ones necessarily entirely that you would give to Asian actors who are being all kind of well, they're quite kind of kung fu and a bit sort of spiritual, but they had
in the Kurosawa kind of way. They were well characterized. They were not black or white. They were just this.
And that is really designed for the China market.
Yeah,
and I don't think that it failed, but I don't think necessarily also that the China market really noticed that they were being pandered to.
I think it's the same with Crazy Rich Asians in the Asian market, because the lead actor is Henry Golding. He's not really a big name. Had they casted someone like
Scarlett Johansson,
Chow Yun-fat, like Lee Hom, or maybe that would have gotten more like audiences in Asia. But Henry Golding, he's a small time like TV host, so even in Asia he doesn't really have much traction. Yeah,
I mean, when you see movies like Kong Skull Island and Independence Day Resurgence, I think it was called, right, the Asian characters in those two movies were literally like stick a Barbie doll in front of the camera and go like, hello, I'm the cute Asian woman. Basically, that's all. Didn't have any characterization, didn't really do anything interesting. And despite the fact that the movies did well in China and did well in Asia, I think completely came up to the special effects. They came for Kong, they came for aliens blowing up half the world. I don't know, because I have not read. Are Asian audiences annoyed with this bland portrayal?
I think it is.
I find it.
And I think it's changing. Yeah. I watched just a few moments of Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom.
But that's a great Asian character.
Really? Really? The little kid. Shorty, isn't he?
Yeah, Short Round.
Short. Wow, what an annoying, me speaking the English indie kind of thing. And then they go to India.
Oh, that was terrible. Yeah. Right? India bits.
And they're eating like monkey brains.
Yeah.
And I don't think Hollywood does that now. I think Hollywood has gone beyond that.
Yeah. That one is given a pass by most people because it's set in the 30s and it's supposed to be a serial
pop kind of thing. In the 80s and stuff.
But that's, Spielberg. Yeah. Spielberg only knows the world through cinema. And I think all his ideas about Asia and India come from the movies that he has seen back in the 50s or... I doubt he watches Bollywood or Hong Kong.
We must move on, though. But I hear what you're saying, and I am sure now that Steven Spielberg right now is going, oh, my God, will this work in Malaysia? It's such an important market. we move on, though, to topic number two, the anatomy of a joke. And I thought it would be a nice opportunity to do this because three of us, in our own way, have worked in comedy over the years. Mm-hmm. And Charmaine, you're a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And you were writing scripts for comedy. Na'ah, you and I, we
wrote for ICT for years. Yeah.
We wrote for ICT for years. And also we wrote for your father.
Yes.
For many
sitcoms.
Years. Sitcoms. Sitcoms and such. So I want to ask, really, what is a joke? And I want to start by telling you a joke. Right?
Okay.
And all you have to do, you two, is say, how does he smell? Okay?
When do we say it?
When I tell you.
Okay.
Okay.
Right? I say, my dog has no nose.
How does he smell?
Terrible.
Ha, 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 ha.
No, well, you laughed sarcastically, but I love that joke. And it cracks me up every time.
Well, I loved that joke when I was six. Eight.
Right. But I think it is the archetypal classic joke. Because for me, my theory with comedy is that a joke is a 90-degree turn. Mm-hmm. In that you create a reality and you seem to be walking along with that reality. Mm-hmm. And then at the last moment... you take in a different direction.
Yeah, playing with language, right? He has a wooden leg named Bob. What's his other leg called, right? It's literally just playing with language.
Like. Well, not just playing with language, but once you then make that 90-degree turn, you've created a new reality.
Yeah.
And if you are now imagining yourself in that reality, and that new reality is bizarre. Mm-hmm. And I think that a laugh is a shock of fear. I think a laugh, in a way, is a moment of, oh, my God, I'm in a new reality, a new world, and I'm confused and frightened.
Well,
and
nervous laughter from seeing something you're unfamiliar with, like walking into a normal place and then suddenly an 8-foot clown pops out behind. That kind of fear?
Yeah, like a nervous scream of fear.
People always laugh when they're uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
It's like an automatic reaction. So, like you say, like I guess that rule also applies in improv. It's always finding what we call the tilt. So like you say, you know, the turn, the tilt, you know, you always, in comedy, you always want to flip it. You want to like...
Unexpected.
Yeah. But also, I mean, with stand-up comedy, when you do a set, when you think of jokes, what you're looking for is what I find is like what you call like common epiphany in the room. So like, you know, you tell a joke and then everyone in the room knows what you're talking about. Yeah. And then there's like that, you know, moment where everyone laughs. So
and you turn it on its head.
Yeah. So that's another part of like, you know, writing a joke, you know, something that everyone will understand, you know, like that common reaction to a joke. Yeah.
See, I think that's a really beautiful moment.
Yeah.
When you can create that joke and that laugh and 300 people are focusing their attention on a single point and making loud their agreement.
Yeah. Right.
And that never happens in any other, apart from maybe sports, you know?
Yeah.
Like right. You're expecting a goal and it doesn't happen, everybody groans. Yeah. Which reminds me, I mean, like the whole, I like the thing which you say, it's a turn, it's something you're not expecting, but everybody understands where you are and yet you go somewhere else. Like this joke, I really like this joke. I heard it recently. How many surrealists does it take to screw a light bulb?
I don't know. How many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Fish. Fish. You know, if you're not on the surrealist track, you don't get the joke. But once you have the turn, gets you, because it's like, of course, surrealist. You'd be fish, right? But you have to get them first, right? If you're not on the same page, then...
And also, like, you know, what do you call it? Read the room, you know. If you do that joke in, like, you know, somewhere where they don't know what surrealism is, then it will just...
Now, to look at it from a slightly different angle, I was watching an interview with Stephen Colbert and Emma Thompson. Emma Thompson, the British actress and one-time stand-up comedian.
And wife of Kenneth Brenner.
Sketch comedy writer.
Yeah, she used to write sketch comedy. Yeah. I read that somewhere.
With Hugh Laurie.
So they were talking about comedy and Stephen Colbert asked her, what was your first joke? And she said immediately, actually, she doesn't like jokes. She thinks that jokes are a male construct in that it is, you know, it's build up, set up, punchline, bang. Yeah. And then it's just again. Whereas she, in her stand-up, she liked to do a story where you would meander around and there would be epiphanies along the way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I think she said there would be... a disappointing ending because that's a much more female experience.
But there will be character moments, right?
Yeah.
Which will make you laugh because of, you know, familiarity or it's just ludicrousness of it. I mean, I've written so much sitcoms for so long that I actually can't stand the form anymore, especially classic sitcoms, you know, the studio sitcoms. It's like, you got to have 8 jokes every 10 seconds or something stupid like that.
Every 30 seconds, laugh breaks every 30 seconds.
Everything has to build up to a joke. Whereas I prefer now to write that kind of character-driven humor where it comes out of the situation, it comes out of the character, it comes out of unexpected things like fish, you know? Yeah. It just happens.
I've been catching up on all episodes of Modern Family.
Wow, great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is great. And like, you know, you're talking about, you know, putting jokes in like scripts. I think Modern Family finds a great balance between like funny situations, funny characters, and you can see where they've added like these jokes, and they're just like sometimes the throwaway jokes get the biggest laughs. So I think it can work if you can find a good balance. Yeah.
But Charmaine, in your stand-up work, you like to tell stories.
Yeah.
So did Emma Thompson's words resonate with you?
It did, because I watched the clip maybe a week ago. And then I was thinking about the way that I write, and yes, I do, you know, tell a story, but within the story, you know, there are certain things that I expand into jokes, like the, you know, usual setup and punchline, setup, punchline. But I think she does make a good point that for women, we're more storytellers. But in today, more male comics are taking that storytelling approach.
Yeah, the raconteur kind of thing.
Yeah.
My brother Jit used to do. Yeah. It's just like, it's a longer story.
Yeah.
It's like along the way, it's familiar, it's interesting, but you know it's building up to one big, huge thing at the end.
Actually, I think most stand-up comedians these days have that storytelling approach. Last weekend, I watched Jimmy Carr. Now, he was doing just short jokes, you know, set up punchline. So I guess he's like the epitome of, you know, jokes are a male construct.
Yeah.
But you don't get a lot of comedians like that these days. Most of them have like a journey in their sets. Yeah.
Who's that American stand-up comedian with the curly hair and he has that kind of drone?
Oh, Steve Wright.
Is that his name?
Steve Wright, back in the day, long time ago.
Yeah, and he does it once where he just goes, sponges in the ocean. Sponges in the ocean. Can you imagine how much deeper the oceans would be without sponges? and that's it. And he moves on to something else. You know, I kind of like those too because it kind of sets up something bizarre. I mean, you have to do it well. It can't be, you know, like it can't be knock knock who's there. You know, it's got to be more sophisticated.
I mean, we must move on. But I should say, we're also with a good delivery of a joke. It's almost the same delivery that you do in tension and thriller.
Yeah.
In that you almost build and build, but you almost you have to almost bore the audience as much as possible. Yeah. Possibly can get away with, and then imagine how much deeper it would be.
And then you second guess the timing.
Wow.
Richard Donner, when he was doing the glass beheading of David Warner in The Omen, he said that at that point, horror movies had a timing where people would close their eyes for 3 seconds. They actually studied this for 3 seconds. So what he did was he shot it so that after 3 seconds, when you open your eyes, the head is still rolling on the glass. So it got a shocked gasp, and people closed their eyes or looked away, and then when they looked again, it was still happening. They got the louder scream. I think they said that even Hitchcock did that, right? Timed all the beats.
That's a comedy classic, that one.
That one, yeah. The Omen. Watch the head.
Quick recommendation. I know this is not the time, but since we're talking about jokes and joke structure and whether it's a male construct, Hannah Gadsby. Nanette, she talks a lot. Oh, have you watched it?
No, I haven't watched it yet. I must
have to watch it. And she talks a lot about something similar with what Emma Thompson said, that comedy is very, the history where it came from, it's a very masculine thing, you know. And she sort of deconstructs the joke structure, punchline.
Oh, right.
And setup and punchline. So yeah, check it out.
So that's homework for all of us then. Yeah. All right. Okay, so we'll move on though. But in a moment, we'll have topic number 3 in part 2 of Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Na'a Mourad, and Charmaine Othman. And now topic number 3, colorblind casting.
Can it work in Malaysia? Recently, iFlix released KL Gangster Underworld, done by Scope. And there were two characters. They were part of a Chinese gang, but they were played by Malay actors. So I just wanted to know, do we think Malaysia is ready for colorblind casting, or we just need to get our casting right
so
first?
So these characters are Chinese characters.
Chinese characters.
They're like called Ah Chong, Ah Lim, or whatever.
Yes.
So you had Malay actors doing the Haya, Gua Manyak Sake, or Kena Timbo, or whatever.
Yes.
Oh, and it's not comedy.
It's not comedy, no.
But maybe they just couldn't find any. I'm going to shooting in 10 minutes. Just you two, you and you.
It's really sad to see, like, you know, when we're talking about, you know, a production for a streaming service and you're not making sure you're casting the right race for these characters, right?
Because that sounds like just bad production.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not like...
Lack of preparation.
It's not like, oh, let's be colorblind and...
If they wanted to cast like these two actors, then maybe they should have just made these characters Malay, right? Yeah.
True. Yeah. I mean, I think colorblind would mean that rather than trying to fool the audience and distracting the audience, you create characters that could be any race, even though, you know, isn't that roughly? A gangster in a Chinese triad could still be Malay. I mean, that happens. Right.
But you and I, we work a lot in, like, you know, script writing for TV. And would you agree with me that most of the time whenever we write, we automatically just cast everyone as Malay, right?
It depends on the story, right? Depends. Sometimes it's just easier that way because.
But do you guys think, like, there's a, you know, we're talking about new Malaysia and we want more like media freedom. But do you think that there's the next step is also like to have more... diverse casting, is that the step that we should be taking, or should
it's not about actors, it's about characters, so it's about finding more diverse characters. But then you actually come back to a very Malaysian thing, which is like, who's available? What actors are there? Who's good? I was like, well, he's like, I don't know, Chinese, but he's a terrible actor. Okay, let's go for the other one.
Yeah.
And you end up writing for who's available.
Yeah.
Or sometimes in this case, I think it wasn't even writing for Wesley. I think the people who wrote the Underworld, don't know what, probably wanted, in their minds, they saw Chukinwa and, you know, whoever else. But
but they're not available. But are we ready for diverse characters? For sure. For sure.
I think we should sort of move on from, what's the term, tokenism?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of, like, when we do our, like, TV series and we have non-Malay actors, we always, you know, put them in, like, token characters rather than, you know, put them as, like, the lead hero or the lead heroine. If we talk about, you know, Hollywood with Crazy Rich Asians, they've already got their leading Asian rom-com couple. When are we going to get our leading Chinese or Indian
expat couple in KL? That would be interesting.
Well, indeed. I don't know. A slightly different thing is, like, if I watch, say, a British TV drama, like a detective show, which is an ongoing drama, they want to be diverse. So the leads are all white British people because that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the slightly more subsidiary characters, they'll throw in minority actors. But they'll often give them positions that are just unrealistic. So suddenly the chief of police is a black guy. A black woman. And she's young. So it's not just the ethnicity that gets me. It's like she's far too young to have become the chief of police. But there she is. She's
In the UK, I've noticed this colorblind thing happening in the UK a little bit. When some of it, and I'm cool with it. I mean, especially if you're doing contemporary stories. But I see a lot of it now in a British period show where you wouldn't imagine that there would be an Asian or a black
Jane
person.
Austin, and suddenly it's like
I don't know. Sometimes it's people of authority, and they're like, wow, wouldn't be a black person back then. Yeah.
So it would have to reflect the
reality.
Right? Yeah. I think there's a lot of talk about James Bond being black.
That's perfectly okay.
He would have joined the army. I mean, black people became part of the intelligence community since the 70s. So it's at school. That makes
but
sense.
But if he's trying to slip in undercover incognito in Sweden, say, then, you know, he might stand out a bit.
We've talked about race and how, you were saying, like, how, you know, you can't just do colorblind casting. It has to sort of reflect the reality of the world, right? So recently, a local production, I won't say which production, so one of the characters was like this high-ranking cop, and they made the character female, and when they submitted the script, they were told, like, no.
There's no such person
exists. This has never been held by a woman. Yeah. So they, you know, that character had to change. But I think there should be room for creators to sort of put these fantasy characters, you know?
I mean, that still makes sense, because you could be, I mean, every single world, every single TV movie, every single film, even if you have characters in real life in it, it's actually a different reality. You know what I mean? It's not exactly our reality, and there's some change. Have you guys seen, I think it was Branagh's As You Like It, or which Shakespearean thing, where he just mixed the world completely with, like, Japanese sumo wrestlers and African
princesses. Yeah, but that's okay because
Shakespeare, that's what you do with Shakespeare.
And he created an alternate reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I take your point, and that argues against what I was saying just now about the
reality of the world. Yeah.
And I'm in two minds, because I do agree with you that having an aspirational
representation is what everyone's talking about.
And if there hasn't been a female in a senior position by now, they really should have been.
They should have been.
And what you said, you should be able to say to the police, what, you're telling me that's never happened? That's disgraceful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if it has never happened, I do believe in reporting back the reality as it actually has been experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is virtue in that. at the same time saying, perhaps there should be a line in there to say there never has been a woman in this position, and there really should have been.
You serve reality by adding the fact that there's a woman as a ESP or whatever has changed things. Maybe you have a simple scene of the people under her being a bit rude to her, maybe, or she having to kick butt all the time in order to get her.
But did either of you ever watch back in the 80s Helen Mirren's Prime Suspect?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I love the
TV show where she is a senior police officer.
Yeah, she becomes a DSI or something by the second season, right? Yeah. She keeps going up the ranks
and
every
season. The story is about her and her team uncovering a series of crimes, but it's also about her as a woman in a position of authority.
And how her team slowly starts to love and respect her. And it's wonderfully done because it's very subtle. Yeah. It's very subtle.
So if, in your situation, Charmaine, if there has never been a woman in that position, then I think that you can't then just write characters willy-nilly.
Yeah. Mm.
You are obviously operating in an environment of systemic... sexism,
patriarchy.
Yeah. And every line from every character needs to reflect that.
Yeah.
And it has repercussions all the way down.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing something like, for example, the Marvel Universe, then you can play around. You can say that the history of this Marvel Universe is women have always been in charge, or whatever. Yeah. You know, then that's fine. But anything more down to earth, more gritty, I think you serve the story better by.
Wow. Charmaine, to conclude then, so where do you fall on this? You asked the question. How do you?
I think we should move towards not just tokenism when we have non-Malay characters, but have them in playing lead characters. I think Mandatory had like the Chinese sidekick, right? Alvin.
Yeah, he was the cop.
Alvin.
Yeah.
So that's one series. But I hope we get to see more of like. Not colorblind casting, like more diverse casting. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, Jibril, we tried to do that. It's like one Malay hero, but we saw it as an ensemble thing anyway. Like four main characters and one of them is Malay.
That's
it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's really hard to, when you're writing yourself, to kick that tokenism thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you are being tokenistic.
But that's true. I mean, sometimes it's the reality of it. If you're writing about policemen, which I rarely do, it's hard for you to see anything else but a bunch of guys with mustaches and they're all Malays, right? I mean, you write a story set in a kampung, automatically, you know.
Yeah.
A friend of mine saw like a fast food ad for Malaysia Day or Merdeka, and it was set in the restaurant, and this Malay lady was like sharing her fried chicken with an Indian guy, and he was like, "That will never happen." Never.
Okay. So anyway, we move on from that, and we now go to the final part of the show: recommendations. Where we recommend something we think might be of interest, and Na'am Murad goes first.
Yeah. Okay. Next year, Peter Jackson and his team will be releasing a movie called Mortal Engines. It's his next big film. It's a post-apocalypse science fiction epic and everything. And it'll be great. Go and watch it if you want to. But it's actually based on an excellent series of science fiction books, the Mortal Engines Quartet. There's also three prequel books set in that universe. To me, even though it's written kind of like for young readers, basically it's not for young readers, but it's written in a way that anybody can read it. Basically, it tries to keep the violence and the anything else, any of that stuff subtle. But I think it's one of the best fantasy science fiction series I've ever read. And do yourself a favor, if you're excited about this movie, you've seen the trailers and you think it's going to be great, please do read the books first, because it will just it'll just lay out this wonderful universe for you. It won't spoil the movie, I hope.
Have you seen the trailers and stuff?
I've seen the trailers,
And what did you think?
I think it's gotten the look down. It's pretty good. I mean, giant cities that actually move. Can you imagine? That's really cool, isn't it? But it's also a very rich universe, character-wise and story-wise. And you can't see that really in the trailers yet. So, I would recommend those books if you're thinking if you're a big fan of Dune and Lord of the Rings or whatever, and you are looking for the next great epic science fiction fantasy series of books. Try the Mortal Engines.
Mortal Engines by
Philip Reeve.
And okay. All right, these are oldie, like back in the day.
Yeah, late 90s, early 2000s. The first. Right. The prequels were done in 2008,
9, 10. Right. Okay. Mortal Engines, huh?
Mortal Engines, Quartet. It's called.
Okay. So now my recommendation is slightly partial, but I feel confident, and it's also a repeat of last week's, which is The Billion Dollar Whale. I am reading the book now. I just started it. It's about, you know, Joe Lowe. Do I need to say who that person is? And it just totally gripped me and couldn't sleep after reading it because it just makes me feel so sad. I felt angry reading it.
That's what I heard. A lot of people are angry.
There was an excerpt in the New York Post or New York Times, and I read that. It's the bit about him,
the party,
the parties, yeah,
which is at the very beginning of the book. And I just, I can't say I'm looking forward to reading the rest. It's because at first I thought, it'll be a fun kind of like, you know. But as you get through, it's like this.
It's an insult. It's an insult to you as a militian that all this happened.
That also that it should have been perpetrated in order to create something so shallow, so nothing.
I know nothing. Mm.
So nothing. Yeah. Except just excess.
Reputation, excess, fun night out. Fun night out. Yeah.
It really is a 13-year-old boy's idea of.
Of what a super millionaire is. Richie Rich, basically. An X-rated Richie Rich.
Yeah. Not even X-rated.
R.
Really? R. It's like, you know, the Tom Hanks movie Big.
Right,
when he swaps body and he's suddenly a 10-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old and he's like, cool toys and everything. He's like that, but he's managed to steal billions.
I know.
I held your copy in and I just touched the book and I'm really angry. So angry. No, but that's why I hear.
Well, start reading it then.
That's why I hear. Everybody who's read it is just furious.
Even that excerpt that I read, like you say, it got me sad.
Sad. I was really surprised that that was actually my main emotion, which is sadness.
Yeah.
But it's so pathetic.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's my recommendation so far. And we'll do a more proper review when I've finished it. Uma read it in like half an hour, so it'll take me about 3 weeks. So it's The $1 billion Whale. Well, you know what it is. It's a book. And
my recommendation, it's happening next month. I don't have a date yet, but it's coming out on Astro. It's my little baby. It's Sedapnya Mulut. It's a stand-up comedy series featuring Malay and English stand-up comics. When I say English, I mean Malaysian comics who do their stand-up in English. We have Malay comics doing stand-up in English, and we have the English comics doing stand-up in Malay. And because it's Malaysia Baru, has the freedom to do their club set on TV and, uncensored. So
you directed this, right?
I produced it. And Jen Han was my material consultant. So we spent a couple of weekends with the comedians making sure they have a tight set. Yeah, so that's coming out in October. So no holds barred.
On Astro.
Just stay tuned.
So you
Astro something.
You're not doing. You don't do a set.
I do a set. I do one set. Yeah.
Because you're crude.
I am. But hey, you know, I think it's great that Astro is moving towards wanting to do more, what they would say, liberated content. So stay tuned. Sedapnya Mulut. October on Astro.
On something on Astro.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, look forward to that. I mean, normally we recommend something that's, you know, it's got nothing to do with us personally. But what the heck? That sounds really good. Well, I look forward to that. And so that brings us to the end of the show. Only remains for me now to thank special honored guest, Charmaine Othman.
Thank you.
And Amurad.
You're most welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations for the great office again.
Well, yes. I wish I could take, well, I'll take the credit, yeah. And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week. And also like our Facebook page. If you like the page, join us next week for another exciting episode of Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.